We're ready to begin the next phase of our discussion. And it's always a good sign when we have to shush the room. All right. If someone, I don't know, it's too bad we don't have a knife that we could tinkle against one of the glasses. Universal sign for be quiet. Listen now. Well, this is our opportunity to listen to you. We have wonderful questions, a long list of questions that came from the audience, and it's our chance to try to get to some of these. I want to begin with a quick question that came from the audience. How can we integrate some of the issues that we're talking about here horizontally with other areas in the Clinton Global Initiative, education, the environment, et cetera? I was compelled by education particularly because that seems to be a key component of what we're talking about. Jay?
Oh, thanks, Michelle. The example I did give is with the major school feeding system, the schemes that have been implemented by a variety of organizations, there's been an encouragement of children going to school, especially in poorer communities, because they get a meal. And I think that there's a multiplier effect. We have to look beyond the product that we are putting on the table as to what are we trying to create. We are trying to create in the way that the Danone project and Grameen Bank project has been implemented, employment. We are putting disposable income in the pockets of people. We are giving people dignity. And that's the big challenge for us today. It has to go beyond just doing good. It's how do we get people to take responsibility for their lives. And I think one of our biggest challenges in conferences like this is that we are full of clever people here with bright ideas and passionate about what they want to do and believe that they can go out there and rescue the world. But there's not a recognition that we actually learn as much from the poor as we are there to teach. There's an indigenous knowledge out there that we've got to respect. We've got to understand how people think. You've got to live with people. You've got to eat with the people. And then you begin to understand that there's actually quite strong organizational networks in these poor communities. That's how they survive. We are not knights in shining armor. And the journey of development is littered with examples of failed good intentions. So I think there's a bit of humility we've got to bring to ourselves. You know, it's great to have movie stars supporting, providing bed nets. It's great to have companies like the Danones of this world committing to do good. You know, but at the end of the day, nothing replaces organizing communities so that we give people dignity, that they take responsibility for their own lives, and we learn to work with people, not for the poor people. And I think for me, that's the most important lesson that I've learned in my life. My most important lessons were learned as a trade union organizer from people who were the most marginalized, the most illiterate, but had the wisdom of how they survived all these hardships.
Other examples of how what we're discussing here can be integrated with some of the other topics, issues, programs that have been discussed in some of the other tracks, sustainability, poverty alleviation, education.
I mean, when you look at integration, particularly in the context that we are referring to, there are several levels. For instance, you integrate the different vertical diseases and the vertical programs, I beg your pardon, and the approaches that they have to over and under nutrition across. So that's one level of integration. And, of course, that's not easy because that's challenged with a lot of turf wars and disagreements over resource sharing and so on and so forth. Secondly is the issue of integrating those with systems that deliver them. Again, that's not, it's easier said, but it's extremely complicated when you get down to doing that. The third level of integration is integrating individual interventions, behavior change campaigns that are focused on individual behavior change with those that are aimed at modifying the environment to support individuals and empower them to make that change. which means essentially combining preventive and health-promoting programs. And then, of course, there is integration across the intersectoral sectors. And in the nutrition domain, integration across intersectoral sectors is hugely important. For instance, if you look at the initiative many of the initiatives that GAIN spearheads in countries, the decision to fortify wheat is completely outside of the purview of the health sector. Of course, that is where you institutionally engage with ministries of health, but it ultimately comes down to agriculture and to the commercial sector and to the industry. So what kind of mechanisms does the health sector, and referring in particular to the ministries of health at a policy and institutional level, have to engage intersectorally? What kind of broad intersectoral objectives do they have? What kind of mandates and prerogatives do they have? And then, of course, there's this huge battery of retailers, distributors, who have to be incentivized to sell wheat that has been fortified with iron or whatever it needs to be fortified with. And similarly, in the case of fortifying margarine and cooking fat with vitamin A, and one could keep iodizing salt, for instance. So integration is not simplistic. It involves several levels, and governments have to be very strategic and savvy with approaching it.
Another question from the working group about the role of women and their specific role in this issue of over and under nutrition. Women are the ones that most influence a family's eating habits, but women are also the ones that are the last to eat in many cultures. And in many cultures, the women are the ones who don't eat if there's not enough food to make sure that others do have enough. So how do you make sure that you teach women proper nutrition? This relates to education, and also encourage them to make sure that they take care of themselves, that it's important to take care of themselves so they can take care of their families. Anne.
Well, I think this is a critical question, and one that I talked about briefly in my opening remarks, and that is you first have to educate the woman to utilize proper nutrition during her pregnancy. Then you have to educate the woman to make sure that she exclusively breastfeeds for 6 months. And then you have to make sure that they understand the need for complementary feeding as the child gets older. And so much of this is very basic. That's in the developed world. But as you say, there's much of it that's cultural, where women often are the ones. The women and even the children sometimes are the ones the last to eat. Sometimes they'll feed the men in some cultures first. I also think that, again, in the developed world where we have, and even in some of the societies where we have this growing issue of obesity, we have to train women who are providing the food for their families for the most part, that healthy eating has to be part of what the child is exposed to. We live in a very fast-paced world, and it's so easy to pick up the fast food that may not be the most nutritious. And I think one of the things that we have to continually do is get messages out there. Obviously, with the growing issues of overnutrition, it's very difficult to do that. But I would say that women play extremely important roles overall in the issue of both undernutrition and the issue of overnutrition and the kind of food that the children are eating.
It's almost like, you know, when you are on an airplane and they tell you to put the adults to put their own life mask on before their children. It seems like that kind of message needs to be conveyed in cultures where women don't always put their needs first. Jay.
Oh. No, I agree. My wife always tells me that you know, you educate a man, you educate an individual, and you educate a woman, you educate a community and a nation. I think that's really true. I think we need more women in power, actually. You know, because I think that in a sense we need to create a caring society, and there's too much testosterone in our global environment today. So women are central, I think. And when it comes down to, you know, the basics, it's women that make the choices about what food to buy, who gets fed first, and I think the empowerment, and at this point I'm saying, we've got to empower women to liberate ourselves. And I think that should be a key objective of all our programs, whether in health or education. And so that's the multiplier effect, why things are integrated. And I think that's for me a critical component of delivering better nutrition.
Now, almost all of you have talked about the role of government, and that's something that obviously touched many of you at your tables because there are many questions that touched on that. So I'm going to try to combine many of these issues into one simple question. In talking about the role of government, I want each of you to think about specific examples of how the government can help, can work as a partner, or how the government can perhaps be an impediment to prohibit or set up barriers to what you're trying to do. And I'm going to reach down at the end, and Bernard, I'd love to start with you with this.
Sorry.
How the government can either be a good partner or can instead put up barriers to what you're trying to do. How government can work or not.
As I told before, I think the initiative by governments to regulate on food content is absolutely necessary on the one hand. We made a survey quite recently about what kids in Indonesia eat at school. There are very small shops in schools, and it's terrible. It's terrible from a food safety standpoint. It's terrible from a nutritional standpoint. So regulation is something very important. But on the other hand, the combination between the private sector and government can be interesting on education and social marketing. How can we join forces to inform the mothers that some products are better than others is absolutely key. When you have very little cash, why would you choose some product instead of another one? And if you want to integrate the cost of education and information in a business model that is very difficult, if you want to really reach the poor in a country, it becomes quite a bottleneck. It's nearly impossible. So we have to join forces in order we can have public plus private organizations such as GAIN, combining public and private, and the initiative of companies.
I'd just like to add to that, and I think when you look at the role of governments in the context that we are describing it in, you have to look at the areas which are the mandate of governments, and that would be the normative side. For instance, it is the mandate of the governments to act stewards, to formulate policy, to coordinate within the health sector, to coordinate intersectorally. It is their mandate to legislate, and these are things that they must do. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is their mandate to regulate, granted that regulation is not coercive, and it must incentivize, and it must be stakeholder-driven and participatory. And that is the bit that they must do. On the normative side, they also have to coordinate the contributions of the different stakeholders. And this is particularly relevant to the developing countries where so many stakeholders are working in the nutrition arena. For instance, it is the mandate of governments to engage with UNICEF. The private sector cannot do it. Or, for instance, to talk to GAIN as to how they can bring the contribution. And on the normative side, they also have to be responsible for creating frameworks for public-private partnerships, mm-hmm. and to create procedural clarity and safeguards against conflict of interest. So if a group down, for instance, was to come in Pakistan, it would not be my job to create those frameworks. I would abide by them. But it would be a job of the governments to have those mm-hmm. in place. And that that normative regulatory side of whatever is overarching to the outcomes, to achieving the outcomes that we're talking about, is absolutely the mandate of governments. They must have the capacity, institutional capacity for that. That is the first. Now, coming down to the role of the governments at the financing side, certain nutrition interventions have to be delivered as a public good. So if it is vitamin and supplementation, iron fortification, or the several others, if governments have to take the responsibility to finance them. And I know that the GAIN model heavily focuses on incentivizing and having the commercial sector pick the costs, but I'm of the opinion that if the commercial sector requires subsidies, it is the job of the governments to give that for achieving that outcome in particular. Then thirdly is on the service delivery side. And here, on the service delivery side, of course, governments need not be the torchbearers of deliverers of services, particularly in areas where they do not have on-ground institutional presence, For instance, in mixed health systems, where more than 80% of the deliveries by the private sector, well, the government cannot just say that we will deliver nutrition interventions through our own outlets or through our own service delivery points. And again, the point about public-private partnerships and how they can enable through the right regulatory frameworks to incentivize delivery through the private sector would be absolutely key there.
Now, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment, but first what we've done is we've taken many of your comments and your questions, and we've integrated them, and Daniel's going to walk us through some of this. Actually, Tom Khalil is going to come forward, excuse me, and walk us through some of this.
Good afternoon. Well, once again, the wisdom of crowds is paying off here, and we have a number of great suggestions, both for themes and specific proposals. There was a lot of interest in the notion of local food production to ensure sustainability. Also the notion of expanding community nutrition programs and focusing those around schools and including both younger siblings and pregnant mothers. And also a lot of interest in seeing if we could integrate exercise and obesity so that it's not just a discussion about food, and a very specific idea, which is to see if we could have a partnership between a food company and a sports company to promote an integrated campaign around both nutrition and expertise. There were also a number of gems. One idea was to create an Innovation and Health Award that would be focused on nutrition, so the best nutrition partnership and the best company promoting nutrition. In the U.S., the Malcolm Baldrige Award to promote quality had a really big impact in the 1980s and 1990s. And so I think sometimes these high-profile prizes, if they're well-designed, can have a real impact. The importance of government policy in terms of things like tax incentives, labeling and mandates, exploring the ready-to-use therapeutic foods that Secretary Veneman talked about for moderate nutrition, malnutrition as well as acute malnutrition, trying to integrate campaigns that address not only nutrition but vaccines, prenatal care, safe drinking water. There was a lot of interest in the social business issue that Bernard touched on, and so there was an idea to have automatic dividends reinvested in these social venture investment funds with an opt-out clause. Interestingly enough, that is shown to be really effective in terms of IRAs. So if you tell people that they're sort of automatically subscribed into it unless they opt out, then the savings rate goes way up. One interesting wrinkle on this idea is the notion of whether sovereign wealth funds could be persuaded to invest in these opportunities. There are a number of large sovereign wealth funds in both the United Arab Emirates and Norway, and could you get them interested in participating in these social venture investment funds? The notion of a global public relations alliance to promote breastfeeding and complementary feeding. And one very interesting idea, which is, you know, in the context of greenhouse gas emissions, people have talked about a feebate, that is, that you tax gas guzzlers and you provide a rebate to cars that get high gas mileage. And should we be doing the same thing with taxing unhealthy foods and providing support for healthy eating habits? So, once again, some spectacular ideas from the room, and now we're going to get an opportunity for some reaction from our panelists. Thank you.
And thank you, Tom. Tom Khalil is the chairman of the Global Health Advisory Group, and many thanks to him because the wonderful programs in this stream that you've participated in this conference have been his doing, and a lot of time and effort has gone into that. So thank you very much, Tom. First, just reactions. I noticed in looking at your body language, I was hearing hums and hums and seeing nods among the panel. What among these gems and these themes and these ideas from the audience do you find interesting?
Michelle, I think that part of our commitments at this Clinton Global Initiative has been around some of these gems. So I know from the GAIN perspective, we already committed to creating an award, and we will incorporate some of these ideas into how we shape this award, because it's the partnership that does it. We're already exploring how to support Danone in creating the social investment funds, and we've gone beyond that. We're talking about creating a premix fund, which encourages the premix industry that produces the micronutrients to lower the costs, so that more it makes it more affordable for manufacturers to add. So we are dealing with issues of setting up funds and investing in products like the product that I think Anne has talked so passionately about, the Plumpy Nut, that type of product, of scaling up the production, of being able to replicate best-case examples in other parts of the world. So to transfer knowledge has been very key to us. But just one last issue that came up in the questions was this issue of subsidies. I think if we really want to help the poor in the world, we've got to use you, who are very influential, to campaign in your countries, in the developed world, to remove subsidies on agriculture. That gives people dignity in the developing world, the poorest of the poor. It puts money in their pockets and empowers them to make decisions about nutrition and everything else in their lives. So I think that's my view on it.
Our former agricultural secretary would have something to say about that, I imagine.
Wow, I really don't want to touch that one, but I do have some thoughts. But let me talk about it from a little different perspective, because I think the very first one on these themes, local food production to ensure sustainability. And I think one of the things we haven't done in this panel is we haven't linked the issue of agriculture enough with the issue of nutrition. One of the most amazing success stories I've read recently is that Malawi this year will become a food exporting country. Now, this is a landlocked country that has basically been food deficit for years. The government came in and started helping supply new seed varieties and fertilizers, and in 2 years, they are a food exporting country. Now, these are the kind of government policies in the developing world that I think can really make a difference and help farmers get going with the right kinds of inputs so they can have a better output and actually put the country in a better position, because they can get also export revenue. I think there's a number of government policies that have played in this country extremely well. The Women, Infants, and Children program, subsidizing milk and dairy-based products and fruits and vegetables for pregnant and lactating mothers and small children. I think that the school lunch programs, both in the developed world and in the developing world, have been very key in terms of helping older children. But if they don't get enough nutrition when they're small, they will have, reduced IQ, making learning more difficult than it otherwise would have been. So you can't just address nutrition through school lunch programs. So I think a number of these are very important. And I think the issue of tying in what are the policies that impact agriculture are critical as we look at the overall issues of nutrition.
Well, because we're rounding the corner in terms of... Oh, Sonia, first, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to respond to the audience before we move on.
In terms of a response to the audience, I think these are brilliant ideas. Mm-hmm. But when you actually translate ideas into tangible actions from an institutional standpoint, you have to look at your strengths and you have to look at your weaknesses. Of course, this initiative has great strengths, but it does not want to take an operational role within countries. Neither does it have the institutional leverage to do that, unless it actively engages with initiatives such as UNICEF or the WHO. And from the sense that I get from being here over 3 days in this great meeting, is that it wants to play an enabling, a mediating, a catalytic role, a role which fosters the building of partnerships. And I think some of the ideas may really not work, some of those that have to do with development of policies within countries or engaging in campaigns or community empowerment and so on and so forth. So we need to look at these suggestions in the context of the strength of the CGI. That's the comment I wanted to make. And I know that you will soon be asking us to round up because I'm looking at
the watch. We're all looking at the clock.
Now that I have the floor, I might as well make my final comment with your permission.
Well, actually, what I'd like to do is ask you in summation before we move to the final phase of our discussion. I'd like you to ask a question. I'd like you to answer a question. It's actually a two-part question. I'd like you to tell me about the one thing that you see as the highest impact opportunity for a public-private partnership, because I want you to do this with the audience in mind, thinking about the one thing that individuals can do as individuals or to perhaps move people in their organizations, in their businesses, move them to action. So one, the highest impact opportunity for a public-private alliance or partnership, and then something else, to leave you all with something to think about. The one person you have met in your work and in your travels that you want people in this room to think about when they leave this room, so that there's some one person that they may have in mind. So perhaps this conversation will continue even though our time is done. So I'm going to begin with you, Anne.
Oh, goodness. Tell me the first question.
The first question.
I got so confused.
Begin with one person. Begin with the second one, because we've been talking a lot about policy here, but really we're talking about people who are struggling to feed their families. Is there someone that you have met in your travels that lingers in your mind and that should linger in ours?
Well, let me just say I've had the opportunity as I've traveled, particularly for UNICEF, to meet so many people that just have inspired me and given me so much hope and yet so much despair. We didn't talk today about an issue that we covered a little bit in the break, and I think when you raise this question, one thing that comes to my mind are the hundreds of children that I've seen that are impacted by HIV and AIDS, many of whom are orphaned, and many of whom do not have enough to eat. The impact of HIV and AIDS on food production, on the loss of farmers, what's happening in southern Africa and the link to nutrition, I think cannot be underestimated. We also have to recognize that as ARVs have become more prevalent in Africa, more available in Africa, we also have to have enough nutrition to be delivered with those ARVs or they can't be absorbed.
Antiretroviral drugs, yes.
Yes. The picture that I saw in my mind, as you said, somebody who would impress me, brought me back to the nutrition, but linked again with the AIDS, which we really hadn't talked about today.
Okay, thank you. Sonia, more importantly, someone who has left an impression on you that we should be thinking about when we think about this issue.
Well, not someone in particular, but like Anne, I think of the hundreds of people or the millions of people out there who've been denied an opportunity by the system, by the society. And I think it's our collective responsibility because of the intellectual pool that we have, because of the pool of resources that we can actually tap into to capitalize that and to make a difference in their lives. But in terms of answering the first limb of your question, in terms of the greatest opportunity in public-private partnerships, of course, there could be various facets of public-private relationships depending on how you characterize the public sector, how you classify the private sector, how you interface them one-to-one or in different groups. But there's one thing that strikes me in particular. When I visit the remotest village in Pakistan or anywhere, for that matter, in any part of the underdeveloped world, there is one thing that is omnipresent. It is Coke, it is Pepsi, and it is some consumer items. There has to be something with the consumer distribution channels that enables them to get to the remotest parts of the world, which we within the social sector have failed to leverage. And I think if there is one thing which has an outstanding opportunity in terms of being capitalized on further, it is the art of marketing. It is the art of leveraging consumer distribution channels to get public goods out, not just in health, but across the social sector arena.
Thank you, Sonia. Jay?
You know, there's a third pillar to this public-private partnership, which are the communities themselves. And I think that they have hopes and they have aspirations and they have views. And in whatever we do, let us have the humility to acknowledge that they have very firm views on what they think they need in their lives. And the person that really inspired, I had the honor and privilege of serving under Nelson Mandela in his first, in the first Democratic cabinet. And the most outstanding characteristic that he showed to me and millions of others is humility. It was an overpowering sense that when you were in his presence, it didn't matter whether you were the Queen of England or you were the sweeper cleaning a house. You treated the same way, with dignity and with humility and with empathy. And that's what I think in the opening plenary, that's what Archbishop Tutu, who's also one of our great luminaries, not just of South Africa, is, can't we just learn to love each other and care for each other, irrespective of whether we're lesbian or gay or, what did he say? About straight? So-called straight. And that's the, I think that's the most important lesson we've got to learn about development.
Thank you, Jay. Bernard.
I'd like to build upon what Jay was saying. I have three people in mind. One I met recently in Kenya. It was a school teacher, and he was showing me the progress they had made in school just because the kids were better fed. Because they had cows in the school gardens, and they had done a very good job to provide safe water to the community. And he was so proud to show me the progress, not on nutrition, on school results. This school was becoming one of the best schools in Kenya in about 3 years' work. The second example is the small community in Tanzania, where we are developing kind of testing on yogurts, and it's a small community. They call it locally the yogurt mamas. It's a small community of women who are producing. So they organize themselves to produce yogurts for their community and provide better nutrition and health. And when I see how fast in over 1 year they have acquired the knowledge for producing the yogurts and distributing in their community, it's really amazing. And the last one is the director of our small factory in Bogra, north of Bangladesh. He's from Bangladesh, and he's so proud when he talks about what he's doing. He's doing business, but he's doing something for his community. And something surprising to me is that when we look for volunteers to work on this type of project, we have to be very careful in Danone, because when you just ask, you have too many volunteers. So the difficulty for us is how you make choice. And so I think this is very interesting. It's a hope. That means that in very big multinational, you have a lot of people who are looking for something else. And it's a very strong leverage for the future for me.
Thank you all so much for your time for this phase. We have two important things that we need to do before we close. We need to get input for next year's Clinton Global Initiative, and Ann Veneman is going to announce our commitment. So hold on just one moment, and thank you very much. Thanks to our panel.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to take the opportunity to invite Mark Van Amergen, Executive Director of the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, GAIN, to the floor. Their commitment is establishing a fund designed to reduce malnutrition by targeting and benefiting populations at risk of vitamin and mineral deficiencies. Come over here. We have to get close. They have to get close for the cameras.
Right. I think we're supposed to.
So, focus here. Oh, yeah. But I got to read about you first.
Okay, go ahead.
GAIN commits to create a $100 million premix fund designed to benefit the populations most at risk of vitamin and mineral deficiencies by providing much-needed fortified food. By improving the quality of vitamins, food fortifications, and disaster relief available, Gaines Premix Fund will help reduce mortality and morbidity, increase cognitive development, and improve the health of 300 million individuals throughout the world. Thank you very much. And I can tell you, UNICEF is very proud to have GAIN as one of our strong partners.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oops, they hooked all these together. Next, Janet Vaught, Chief Executive Officer, World Heart Federation, and Gary Nell, President and CEO of Sesame Street. These are the organizations, of course, are the World Heart Federation and Sesame Workshop, and the commitment is using television as a vehicle for improving the health and well-being of young children aged 3 to 6, and I know that most of you are aware of the Sesame Street characters. We have one that we have jointly developed in South Africa, Cammy, who talks about what it's like to be a child living with AIDS. But this commitment is approximately $2.08 million over 3 years to promote healthy living to children. The World Heart Federation will produce Plaza Sesamo, a Spanish-language version of Sesame Street designed to emphasize the importance of a good diet, physical activity, and an understanding of the human body, especially the heart. Plaza Sesamo will be aired primarily in Colombia, where cardiovascular disease now claims more lives than violence, hunger, and communicable diseases combined. I found that amazing. Very interesting. Congratulations, and thank you so much. You get to keep that.
That doesn't require
it. You don't have to give it back. next, I'd like to invite to the stage Kathy Spahn, President and CEO of the Helen Keller International, and Tammy Oppeler, Director of the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation. Tammy, I'm sure I messed up your last name terribly. How do you say it?
Opperly.
the commitment is sprinkles for rural India. And for those of you who don't know what sprinkles are, it's a fortification supplement. Oh, yeah, that's it. We've been partnering with them on this as well, and this is a very important fortification opportunity for use in the developing world. But Helen Keller International and the H.J. Heinz Company Foundation are making $300,000 in commitments to distribute sprinkles, a vitamin and mineral supplement, to 6.5 million children in India, providing the necessary iron, iodine, and vitamin A for a healthy diet. This is a pilot project that will hopefully provide a model for states in India to distribute multi-micronutrients in a national effort to fight iron deficiency anemia. Congratulations. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I get to stay.
You get to stay.
Because it's warm up here.
Kathy's going to stay here. CEO of Helen Keller International, and we are going to invite Angora Tano, Director General. What is this? Cosmivore, and President of the Association of Oil Producers United in Monterey and Economic Union of West Africa. How did I do? Really messed it up? This is a commitment to fortify West Africa. The partnership is among Helen Keller International, the Association of Oil Producers United in the Monterey and Economic Union of West Africa, the Monterey and Economic Union of West Africa, and the West African Health Organization. The Fortify West Africa initiative will fortify cooking oil and cereal flour with vitamin A to reduce health problems and child deaths among 60 million people in 8 countries: Benin, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Niger, Senegal, and Togo by the year 2010. This unique $5.65 million collaborative venture between a U.S.-based organization and private industry in Africa will save the lives of an estimated 100,000 children per year. Helen Keller International hopes to capitalize on the momentum of the regional vitamin A fortified cooking oil initiative to accelerate mandatory fortification of centrally processed cereal flours in the region. As fortification has begun in 2 countries in the region, Cote d'Ivoire and Mali, this commitment will bring fortification to the other 6 countries in the zone. Congratulations. I'd like to acknowledge Project Healthy Children, represented by at CGI by David Dodson, for its commitment to advocate for mandatory government-led food fortification interventions, evaluate effectiveness of food fortification, and help streamline efforts to distribute micronutrient supplements through proven public health programs in Rwanda. As we have just heard, food fortification is a wonderful tool for combating micronutrient deficiencies, so we thank you for your commitment. Is David Dodson here? Thank you. We would also like to acknowledge the Management Education and Research Consortium, represented by Guy Pfefferman, for their commitment to work with African business schools to deliver leadership and management training programs for the health sector. Thank you. Thank you very much, and I think Tom Cahill is now going to finish up here.
Well, I need to do a couple things. First of all, I want to thank the incredible team that has been involved in putting this event together. It's a little like Tom Sawyer and the White Picket Fence. My job consists of getting other people interested in helping me paint the fence. And I just wanted to tell you about just a few of the people who have been working tirelessly on this effort. Hillary Friedenthal, Stephanie Weber, Heather Kinlaw. Is Ellen here, or is she roaming the halls? Ellen Levy. Please, if we could have all of the table facilitators and theme team members please stand. Really done a phenomenal job. And then I also want everyone who served on my advisory board to be please stand and be recognized as well. So I've got a couple quick housekeeping announcements. The first is that the plenary session is going to begin at 1:45. It's going to begin at 2, but you should be seated by 1:45. So you have a little over half an hour to grab some lunch out in the hall and bring it back. The second thing I wanted to tell you is that you have an opportunity to sign this gorgeous globe if you're a CGI member in the lounge over there. And the third thing I wanted to tell you is that we need to begin to prepare for President Clinton a list of potential working group sessions for next year's CGI. And so if you have an idea, please jot it down and send it over to the theme team, and we'll be capturing those. And if you want to put your contact information on that as well so that we can follow up with you, that would be terrific. Thank you, everyone who has made CGI a successful event, and look forward to continuing to work with you. Thank you very much.